than a job title and a temporary home address, it's hard for most of us to find much that Barack Obama and Donald Trump had in common. In fact, though, despite radically different political styles, both of them recognize the value of mobile devices to speak directly to voters without pesky media gatekeepers, and their embrace of platforms that make constituents feel like they're directly connected to their leaders helped spark a revolutionary and likely permanent change in the way politics gets done in the United States. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth Losh is Duane A. and Virginia S. Dittman Professor of American Studies and English at William & Mary. In her book, Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection, she explores how recent administrations have grappled with the power and the demands of these new communications technologies, including expectations of radical transparency and relationships with voters that at least feel direct and intimate. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
I'm delighted to be here.
So we are all aware of how Donald Trump used digital platforms to leapfrog traditional media gatekeepers and take his messages directly to constituents. What sort of groundwork was laid for him by his predecessor, Barack Obama?
Yeah, that's a really important point, because often Obama and Trump are seen as polar opposites, and yet they both ran as political outsiders. They both used social media and smartphones to give their followers that sense of intimacy and inclusion that that direct address via your mobile phone can make you feel. And they both really energized and inspired those followers to use social media as a means not only to show images of their political leaders, but also kind of insert themselves in the frame, right? Make their own discourse to those leaders part of the story.
When Obama was first gaining national recognition as a candidate for the presidency, he was known for his love affair with his BlackBerry, which before smartphones was kind of the hot technology. His administration and his campaign did seem drawn to whatever Silicon Valley thought might offer them an advantage, didn't they?
Yes, and certainly it's interesting to contrast that optimism about digital technology with some of Trump's sort of more pessimistic messages about big tech at the end of his term. And we even see a distrust of things like voting machines and smart home devices. So it's a whole range of digital technologies that become suspicious to Trump. But you know, when we look back at the rise of Obama, you know, one thing that's often forgotten is part of how he successfully ran against Hillary Clinton and ran this grassroots campaign is he actually had his own social media platform before social media was that commonly used. It was called mybarackobama.com, sometimes abbreviated to MyBo. And people who were Barack Obama enthusiasts could find other like-minded people. So if you were an air traffic controller and you liked Barack Obama, you could meet other air traffic controllers who liked Barack Obama. Or if you were a tango dancer, you could find other tango dancers who liked Barack Obama. And these are all real examples. So in some ways, My Barack Obama was a kind of training wheels for social media use before people were really familiar with it. And that's no accident, because that platform was actually developed by one of the designers at Facebook. Hmm.
And it was also in some ways an ancestor to the transparency that Obama as president would endorse. What were these back-end features available at MyBo that kind of regular users wouldn't normally be able to access on a social media platform, but could there?
Yeah, so you would actually get data about other voters in your district, so that a lot of the tools that would normally be available to a canvasser or a local election person for the party these tools are actually there on your MyBo dashboard. And this was intended to kind of encourage people to really enlist their neighbors, enlist their friends, enlist people in the community. So it was both an online and an offline community in some way. So it did use this sort of mix of face-to-face and online interaction.
So people on that site could meet one another, they could generate their own content and post it there, and in return, the site's administrators receive data about those users. What made that information valuable first to the Obama campaign and later the entire DNC grassroots digital infrastructure that they sort of handed it over to?
Yeah, and part of why the platform didn't really survive after the inauguration was that there was a sense that it was no longer a grassroots organization. It had really become an extension of the Democratic Party. But during its heyday, people would often compete with each other. Just as there's sort of friendly competition on sites like Facebook about, you know, how many steps did you walk using your smart app on your smartwatch to sort of share that information, or what's your Wordle score, right? There was this ability where you could share your stats in terms of doing good work as a campaign organizer.
So after the inauguration, how did the Obama administration project an embrace of digital transparency across the federal government?
Well, what's interesting about that inauguration is before it even happened, there was a transitional website called change.gov, which was a website for the president-elect. And one thing to know about transitions between administrations, you know, particularly in the United States, where we seem to go back and forth from Democrat to Republican and back to Democrat, is those transitions could be pretty rocky. And often there were situations where people would actually come into the White House and they would find, in the case of the transition to George W. Bush, they would find that that smartphones were missing, or that keyboards had been covered with glue, or letters had been removed. And so there was all this sort of petty vandalism, but there was also sort of a serious problem with files not being available. And so they kind of created this change.gov website before they were on whitehouse.gov as a way to facilitate that transition. And on change.gov, they promised radical transparency. That was the big promise, that you would be able to see everything that your government is doing, that you can drill down into the data, that you would know if your politicians were meeting with lobbyists. Right? You would have all of this information that would normally be kept private or would be stored only in paper form, and that would be much more freely available. Of course, the odd thing about change.gov is it also ended up becoming a vehicle for spreading the administration's messages. So it started as, this is a way we're going to gather your stories, this is a way we're going to gather your photographs, we're going to, you know, this is a place you can apply for jobs in the administration because we're not going to have the spoils system, it's not going to be a bunch of cronies. But then you just start getting a lot of targeted emails from Podesta, and you know that what you've signed up for isn't really transparency.
And it turns out, even to the administration's champions of that kind of transparency, there were benefits, but there were also costs to putting all that out there.
Yeah, I think that we understand a lot more today about the ways that transparency can make us vulnerable. Although, if you remember back to 2 years before the Obama election, the midterm elections, both the House and the Senate were lost. It switched over from being Republican to Democratic. And part of why that happened was there was a seemingly private activity that was made public thanks to digital media. So in one case, a Republican congressman had been sending inappropriate messages to underage pages. And in another case, a candidate for Senate was captured uttering a racial slur on the campaign trail. And of course, the slur went onto YouTube. So the thing is that often people want to keep private behavior private. And digital technology makes it possible for all kinds of behavior to be broadcast all around the world. And that's something that certainly Hillary Clinton felt very keenly in her own run for office.
You know that Google as a corporate entity celebrated the Obama White House. How deliberately did Obama and his staff cultivate that relationship?
Yeah, that's a really interesting issue, because I think that we have a tendency to think that, you know, we're having a kind of crisis about big tech and should it be regulated? And I think these questions were really coming up very early, but that the Obama administration really benefited from these close relationships, particularly to Google and Facebook. And you see things like the White House Science Fair with Google all over it, and examples, you know, Barack Obama speaking inspirationally about his visits to the Google headquarters, or bringing in people from Google to fix healthcare.gov when the website for the Affordable Care Act crashed in a rather spectacular fashion. And those involved with the Google Transparency Project actually looked at all of these examples in which Google's lobbyists and personnel were really in the White House meeting with administration officials quite frequently. And so because the Obama administration really had benefited from both directly and indirectly from its partnership with big tech, in the book, I'm arguing that those kind of cushy deals encouraged administration officials to defer much needed regulatory intervention.
How did digital town halls evolve as a means of at least appearing to directly connect politicians and constituents?
Yeah, well, the digital town hall actually predated Obama. We, you know, tend to think of Obama as the first digital politician, but there were actually politicians before that who used the digital town hall as a format. The mayor of San Francisco, for example, had chat with the mayor as a form of digital town hall. But Obama really took the digital town hall to a new level. So, you know, he embraced the YouTube town hall format when it was used in the Democratic primary. He was someone who had a Twitter town hall. He had a Reddit Ask Me Anything. So all of these situations in which it seems like citizens can participate directly in their government and ask their leaders direct questions, sometimes questions that involved kind of a potential confrontation, it seemed like digital technology would allow people to have a lot more access to their elected officials and opportunities to participate in the government. But in the book, what I'm arguing is when you look closely at these actual town halls, there were often ways that they were really controlled and micromanaged, so that the message, controlling the message, was really much more the focus of the town hall. And it was really much more about public relations than real engagement in the with the public in many ways.
So the participants were, in effect, cast in advance.
In some cases, they were cast in advance. In some cases, questions were really curated and selected. If you think about, you know, the first White House town hall in which Obama is sort of laughing about the fact that the top question asked was a question about legalization of marijuana, you know, he like turns it into a joke. But that was actually the question that was considered most pressing.
We should pause here, Elizabeth, to ask, you know, it is very easy for people to feel, relatively easy for people to feel as if what they have posted to a politician, you know, if a politician has liked something they've written or a politician's, you know, campaign mechanism, are people really trying to get things done, or are there a lot of people satisfied by getting attention for what appears to be a political utterance?
Well, I'd say it's a mix of both, that people want to feel that emotional reward from having their kind of performance of identity recognized and validated. But there are also ways that people are genuinely trying to influence policy by using social media tools. And if they're doing it as individuals, unless they're a celebrity influencer, it's pretty hard to have that impact. But one of the things I'm arguing about Donald Trump is when you look back at the beginning of his political career on Twitter, he's actually a very skilled user of that particular social media platform in l sort of retweeting content and responding to it. The media has a tendency to cover tweets from Trump that function as sort of headlines or sound bites to be recirculated in the news, sometimes to cause kind of consternation or build a story around. But remember, Donald Trump authored like 50,000 tweets. And I'm interested in those tweets that don't always get on the news, that are really much more about building solidarity within his own community and energizing his followers and making them feel seen, that might not seem as newsworthy or important, and therefore they don't get that attention and coverage.
People who only know about Donald Trump's Twitter presence from other media organizations that sort of cover that may not realize he is a champion user of the emoji. Those are usually stripped out of reproduced tweets. Why should that matter?
Well, there are a couple of reasons that emoji are interesting, and it's true. Donald Trump, his favorite emoji is the American flag emoji, which he used hundreds of times in his career on Twitter. But first of all, emojis are really important at telegraphing emotional connection. And that can be really important for firing up your base, which is really a key aspect of the Trump political strategy. Another thing to remember about emoji is we are often deluged with streams of social media. There's a lot of text that's coming down our screens. And so as you're scrolling rapidly through these feeds and timelines, emoji do stand out, right? They are visually distinctive. And it's also a way to add extra commentary, which is something that Trump loves to do in his social media presence. And so it's interesting to see how sometimes he would actually retweet a message from a media figure and add emojis to it. So just adding that amplification. And really, it's about that strong sense of polarization as well. If we think about emojis, there are not a lot of emojis that are sort of meh emojis, kind of in the middle emojis. There are a lot of emojis that are about loving or hating things.
Going back through the history of all tweets ever issued by Donald Trump, what did you learn about what he learned by trial and error about the kinds of things that would get him the most traction?
So I think definitely live tweeting events, he figured out pretty early, giving his audience that sense of immediacy and that they were having a kind of real-time experience, taking advantage of that sort of FOMO fear of missing out by having it be live is important. So, you see Trump tweeting his show, The Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice, right? You see him tweeting the Oscars. He's then tweeting political debates. So this ability to sort of kind of hook into the attention of the audience in a particular moment in time. So there is a time urgency around his communication, I think is a definitely an important factor. It's interesting to see how his different social media handlers had different philosophies. I particularly like the example of his second social media handler, Justin McCauney, who went on to do a lot of work on Instagram for the band Aerosmith. But while he was Trump's sort of digital person, he said at one point when he realized that Trump was authoring his own tweets and wasn't going through McCauney anymore, he said it was like the moment in Jurassic Park where the scientists figure out that the velociraptors can open doors for themselves. And he said, oh no. So, this sort of degree to which his handlers have kind of let Trump be Trump, I think is interesting to follow.
Digital forensics has revealed some patterns about Trump's tweets that might indicate the ones that were perhaps generated by him personally as opposed to some staff member tweeting in his name.
Right. So the tweets that were outside of business hours or from his personal Android device seem to be sort of more of that kind of unfiltered, non-PR Trump. And the ones that were coming during business hours, those were often kind of collaboratively written tweets. One thing I'm interested in, though, is as the administration wore on, those collaboratively written PR tweets actually became more Trump-like. And so there was a recognition among his communication strategists that sometimes meanness pays off. And they would actually say, how do we make this sound meaner? And kind of working collectively at that process.
To go back for a minute into the Obama administration, I want to talk about We the People, which was set up to facilitate online petitions starting in 2011. How did people use it, and why did it ultimately, I guess, struggle under the weight of its own success?
So, like the town halls, the online petition portal was supposed to be an opportunity for people to really take advantage of that opportunity to participate in policymaking. And so one of the issues, though, for the Obama administration is one of the most popular petition topics involved Barack Obama's birth certificate. So there was a sense right away when We the People was introduced that it was sometimes being used by people who really didn't have a constructive interest in supporting the administration. And then later on, it just sort of got overwhelmed with tricksters and trolls who were, you know, they had funny petitions and things about extraterrestrials and things about kind of wild situations. And of course, you know, when Trump became president, it became all about, you know, releasing Trump's tax records, and then it became all about different conspiracy theories. And so it really, like many things on the internet, as a platform intended for positive communal expression, sort of degenerated into trolls.
Some of the effects of all this online communication have been subtle but really fascinating. You note that President Obama's releases starting in 2009 of his summer reading lists, on the one hand, celebrated books and authors, on the other hand, very much defined reading as a vacation activity, something we do only when we don't have anything else competing for our attention.
I think one important trend that I'm tracking in the book is the rise of the influencer. And so in the beginning, there was sort of this sense that individual citizens could have an impact by using digital technology. And then it became clear that there were these power users with a lot of followers who were really able to influence the cultural conversation. And so I think it's interesting that even before Obama left office, he served as a kind of influencer. Right? He was shaping cultural tastes, first cultural tastes around reading. And it's funny to look at his summer reading list because it's a pretty virtuous summer reading list, right? There's not a lot
There's
of
no Danielle Steele on there, right?
No. You know, I've taught some of the books on Obama's summer reading list, so you know they're a lot of them are pretty rigorous. But then it became about music, so he was also releasing a Spotify playlist. So there was a sense that even after Obama was going to leave office, there would still be this sort of Obama in the background, Obama as a sort of taste maker, Obama as someone who's sort of shaping these sort of ambient trends that are maybe not as obvious as political policy choices.
How did the growing importance of digital communications ultimately harm Hillary Clinton's campaign to succeed Obama into the White House?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people say Hillary Clinton lost because she was a woman, that it would have been impossible the Americans were not ready for a female president. And then there are also a lot of people who say Hillary Clinton lost because of technology, right? She made decisions about the management of her email that either made her seem sort of crafty and duplicitous, or they made her seem incompetent and someone not to be trusted with state secrets. But I'm interested in actually the ways that gender and sexuality actually got kind of tied in with the ways that her digital behavior was discussed. So often her digital assumed misbehavior was tied to different sexting scandals. So tied to the sexting scandal of Anthony Weiner, or tied to the texting scandal of Peter Strzok. You know, these different sexting scandals that actually involved men who were sort of perceived of as being in her orbit, those kind of created an environment of guilt by association. And I think the sense that the standards for digital purity are much higher for female candidates than for male candidates, I think, is certainly a factor. I mean, look at what's happened to the Finnish prime minister to have, you know, her behavior at a party become something that has become sort of fodder for the gossip mills.
It's interesting, Elizabeth, you also point out that Hillary Clinton and or her campaign leaned into a kind of gendered reason why some of her alleged errors with email deserve to be overlooked. She said, well, I'm working on my daughter's wedding and that stuff is private, and that's why I pulled it off the servers.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that her handbag became sort of a point of contention, right? That she couldn't have two phones, one for work and one for her personal life. Because, you know, she's got this big old handbag and she doesn't want to be fishing around in there for two phones. So that there are ways that kind of gender played into all of these different aspects in which she's trying to explain her digital behavior. Of course, the funny thing, when you look really closely at those, at the materials on WikiLeaks that are from her emails, is you see that a lot of times she's actually asking other people to print out documents for her just because the State Department's secure systems made it very difficult to sometimes have things on paper. And she really had this strong preference for paper. That was actually one thing that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump shared, is a general desire to actually have material on paper rather than have it accessed solely digitally. Trump used to have his assistants print out all the stories about him in the newspaper and on other online media sources every morning so they could look at the actual printouts rather than read them off a screen.
Why was it such a big deal when Barack Obama first allowed people to take selfies with him and then on an occasion or two, very notably, took selfies himself?
So, yes, the funeral of Nelson Mandela, at which Barack Obama posed for a selfie with two other heads of state, was certainly another case in which kind of improper digital behavior became a kind of alarm bell for the right. There was also the case in which he gave an iPod to Queen Elizabeth that was also a story for quite a while. But I think what's interesting about that selfie taking is, yeah, it's like a moment in which he sort of seems unpresidential, but it's also a moment that potentially makes him relatable to a certain demographic, right? A lot of different kinds of people take selfies. And they take them for all kinds of reasons. You know, we have these cases where there's consternation because someone's taking a selfie at a place of historical pain or trauma. And then it might turn out that that person has a family member who wants to actually see that they visited the site and, you know, to show that they were there, that they paid homage to that, you know, tragic memory can be important for people. And so he actually tried to turn it into a PR move. He made a lot of jokes about selfies to try to promote signing up for the Affordable Care Act or, participating in STEM initiatives. So he tried to take it from a negative to a positive. And now I think that you'll see shooting selfies with your constituents or shooting selfies even with other foreign leaders has become remarkably common. And, it used to be in the old days, it was really about shaking hands and kissing babies. But now politicians are really expected to pose for selfies. And, even Vladimir Putin has posed for selfies.
So Elizabeth, Obama and his team really positioned him as a very with the times sort of commander in chief. But there were some really embarrassing failures during the Obama administration, notably that botched rollout of the Obamacare website. I mean, you can argue he wasn't directly involved. You can also argue the buck stops with the president. What went wrong and how did the administration try to cope with the fallout from that?
Well, one of the things that I'm really grateful for in this book is I was really able to talk to a lot of administration insiders about their experiences. And, one of the best descriptions of what went wrong with the healthcare.gov website is Tom Cochran described it as like a game of telephone in which each person makes the problem with the launch appear less urgent. So people who are closest to these problems are saying, oh my goodness, the site is not ready. And we've had all this hype about the launch, but it's just not ready to go. And that goes up to their superior and they're like, well, a few bugs, but it's gonna be fine. And then the next person is like, oh, maybe a hiccup or two, but we should be ready to go. And then, the person at the top is like, well, yeah, everything's gonna be great. And so this sort of these different levels of miscommunication created a problem. Also, just the way that government bureaucracy functions is not well designed for software engineering, particularly when there had to be a lot of different vendors and service providers coordinating together to produce this website. And finally, it's important to remember that there was also the possibility, and in fact, there seems to be some evidence for this, that there were coordinated denial of service attacks that were being led to, that were contributing to some of the site's problems. So, for example, whitehouse.gov is by many people's estimate the most attacked website in the world, right? People are always trying to bring down whitehouse.gov. And, a similar thing happened with healthcare.gov, where people who were really opposed to the Obama agenda used it as an opportunity to encourage others to go after the site.
How did the meaning of the term fake news morph for all of us due to the way Donald Trump used the term?
Yeah, one of the things I do in the book is do a kind of deep dive into fake news. And I actually look back way before the digital era, because one of the things I'm arguing is that anytime we have a new communication technology, there tends to be a sort of moral panic about will that new communication technology be used to spread false information. And so the classic example is the War of the Worlds broadcast when Orson Welles created what seemed to be a relatively harmless radio teleplay about Martians invading planet Earth. And because of certain accidents in the programming schedule and the ways that the broadcast was revised in order to be more realistic, many people thought that Martians really were invading the Earth. So, I would say that anxiety about communication technology and fake news isn't new. And in fact, many people wrote to the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, after the War of the Worlds broadcast to say, hey, something's got to be done on this about this radio. It's too full of fake news. But one of the things I kind of follow in the book is once fake news became sort of a digital phenomena, it used to be considered kind of humorous and satirical. And so one thing we tend to do is we tend to assume that all fake news is just designed for misinformation. And fake news can have many purposes. It can be designed for satire. It can be designed to be clickbait. So you're getting somebody to look at a sponsored message or buy something. or to get a click to get some information about behavior. And sometimes a fake news story isn't actually untrue, it's just not news. So sometimes you'll see a fake news story circulating that are actually true, but they are about something that happened many years ago. But they're being shared as though there's something that just happened. And it's that element of novelty that's often important in fake news. I think one of the things about Donald Trump is, he connected to some of these fake news stories that were tied to conspiracy theories. And I think that energizing of the part of his base that was connected to things like QAnon, and I do a kind of deep dive on where Pizzagate came from, I think that that was actually, again, a really important way of amping up the emotions for his base. And then ultimately he turns the term fake news on itself. And he says everything that's we would consider traditional news is fake news. So now everything has become fake news. The New York Times is fake news. CNN is fake news. NPR is fake news. Everything is fake news.
I've always thought it was interesting that things are, especially in the estimation of Donald Trump, these legacy media organizations are churning out fake news until occasionally they have a story that seems to favor his perspective. And then he says, look, even NPR and the New York Times are right. Corroborating what I have to say.
And one of the things that's interesting about Donald Trump's engagement with social media is he really did, particularly in the beginning of his career, want to reach those mainstream journalists at places like the New York Times and the Washington Post. And he was really trying to use Twitter and to a lesser extent YouTube as a way to really answer those critics. He wanted to create a platform for defending his reputation because, he couldn't necessarily do that on Celebrity Apprentice.
How did The Apprentice perhaps give clues that we didn't know to look for about Trump's attraction to an autocratic leadership style?
Yeah, so I watched a lot of episodes of The Apprentice and particularly focused in on the ways that digital technology appears in those episodes. So I'm really interested in the ways that the cell phone is often used as a plot device in those shows, or the ways that technology is depicted in ways that show men as more competent with technology than women, or white people as more competent with technology or more trustful with technology than black people, and sort of the ways that, there are often other anxieties being expressed about difference that sort of come through on that show. The other thing that I was looking for very closely on that show is what's said about politics, what's said about consensus, what's said about the ways that we work together as citizens. And there are some very negative messages on The Apprentice. There is the message of, cutthroat competition, right? So extreme polarization between interest groups. So you're really fighting for your own interests and there's no compromise possible, right? Because that would cause you to be a loser. So this world that's divided into winners and losers is a very binary world. And it's also a world in which very strong leadership styles are emphasized, right? You are supposed to be a top-down powerful executive rather than someone who operates by consensus.
Do you think without the sort of image boost that show gave Donald Trump that he would have been a viable candidate for president?
I think that it was certainly important in contributing to his fame. Not all people who are television famous become successful politicians. That's something that certainly has been shown. And it's interesting to actually look at the midterm elections and see how, the Dr. Oz Fetterman race is shaping up and to see how social media is being deployed in that race. But I do think it was an important element. One of the things that I'm arguing throughout the book is it wasn't digital media alone that brought Donald Trump to the pinnacle of power. It was actually the ways that he used digital media with traditional media in order to really dominate the news cycle. And the interesting thing about Donald Trump is, you know, both people who love him and people who hate him consume news about Donald Trump. And so, you know, for a lot of news organizations, they had a real interest in covering Trump-related stories.
So now, Elizabeth, we have President Biden, who turns 80 in a couple of months, which is to say spent the vast majority of even his adult life before these technologies were available. I mean, that so did Donald Trump, we should note. But you remind us that early in Biden's campaign for the White House in 2020, he did seem to struggle a little to figure out the role digital technology should play. But while he was home in the beginning of the campaign season because of COVID, he made use of what you call a credibility bookcase. And I love this term because once we hear it articulated, we know exactly what it is and we will never not see it in somebody's house. So what is a credibility bookcase?
So the credibility bookcase is the bookcase that is behind you that signals your expertise and authority. And so, you know, when I'm asked to give an interview in which you can see video of me, I generally do have a bookcase behind me. I have other things that are visible as well, but I think that it's become part of the established vocabulary of communication when you're using a technology like Zoom. And I think that, you know, it's interesting to see variations in the credibility bookcase on people who use other things in the background. And one of the things about Kamala Harris that was interesting is how she sometimes on her Instagram would use the kitchen as a background. So she was actually trying to sort of soften her image of authority in order to be more palatable to people who might be resistant to her history as a prosecutor and public figure.
There is lots of speculation that Donald Trump will want to run again in 2024. Can he build the kind of momentum he needs without access to Twitter and Facebook, where he's, you know, quite publicly had problems and been removed?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Obama began his career with a social media platform, and now Trump perhaps is ending his career on a social media platform, Truth Social. Which has certainly struggled from a monetization standpoint. And it faces certain regulatory hurdles. But in the book, I talk about the different ways that Trump has actually tried to get around big tech companies before. The 140 character limit that used to be on Twitter would drive him crazy. So he would create these YouTube videos where he would have sort of longer rants than were possible on Twitter. So it's interesting to see him trying to create workarounds now that he's deplatformed for the time being. Twitter benefits from Donald Trump being on Twitter. He draws an audience. People who hate him tweet at him. People who love him tweet at him. And, you know, I'm not sure from a financial position how much longer Twitter is going to hold out. And I think certainly someone like Elon Musk, you know, in his bid to take over Twitter, made it quite clear that he would probably be bringing Donald Trump back. So we'll see how long Donald Trump is deplatformed. For me, you know, the big question is, what if we have someone other than Trump or Biden? Who might that outsider be? And how might they use social media in some of the ways that we see Obama and Trump doing so?
In 10 seconds, if you had to make a guess as to someone who's really good on social media that could mount a White House challenge, who would that be?
That's a really good question, because people often point to people like AOC and Beto O'Rourke as being skilled on social media as potential Democratic challengers. And then, you know, we look at, you know, people from, you know, particularly the big states like Florida and Texas in the Republican Party as potential challengers. But I'm not quite seeing anybody with that traction yet who's able to really energize that grassroots base in the way Obama or Trump did.
Elizabeth Losch is Duane A. and Virginia S. Dittman Professor of American Studies and English at William and Mary and author of Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. Elizabeth, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Search for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.